He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So here's a list of some occupational hazards. Shortness of breath, blood cancers like Hodgkin's lymphoma, painful black pustules on the hands. And these sound like the kind of ailments you get, I don't know, coal mining, working with asbestos. But these are the health complications that come with working in a nail salon. The New York Times has done an investigative series on the abuses many workers face, from health hazards to discrimination to horrible wages. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about how an everyday grooming practice has become dirty business is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration there. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello, Nancy.
Hey there.
So, Nancy, this was a very upsetting series. Tell us what's going on here.
So, dear listeners, a New York Times reporter, Sarah, I believe it's Maslin Nier, N-I-R, has written two very long stories that ran Saturday and Sunday on the front page and then jumped into the middle of are a whole page long. And they are extremely detailed. They are about the supply chain, if you will, for pedicures and manicures. And it's the story centers in New York City, although she has national data. And the first story deals with the labor practices of all these small businesses. These aren't, for the most part, chains. They're small businesses mostly owned by immigrants. Korean immigrants are the most popular. Korean owners are the most popular, most numerous owners of nail salons. But there are also Chinese and Vietnamese and some European owners. And the labor practices are quite shocking. They employ largely immigrant labor themselves, not necessarily from their home country. It's very, very common practice to not pay workers. You bring them in, they work 10, 12-hour days for months without any pay. Some of them have to come up with $100, $200 to be trained. They're still not being paid. There's virtually no overtime in the business, even though all this is regulated. When they are finally paid, often 2, 3, 4 months into the time they've been logging time, right, you know, filing off calluses, putting nail polish on, moving towels, et cetera, cleaning up. When they're finally paid, the average pay, as best that this reporter could reconstruct, because we don't have a lot of records and the state hasn't kept careful, or the city hasn't kept careful tabs on labor practices, the pay average seems to average somewhere about, you know, $30 to $40 a day for a 10-hour day. Some of them get to keep their tips. Many don't. Often tips are withheld. She documented lots and lots of instances of what most of us would call some kind of abuse. It is a dirty, nasty, very, you know, I'm sure for a lot of consumers, surprising picture. And P.S., the average cost of a manicure in New York City is about $10. The average cost of a pedicure is about $20. So when a reporter, Ms. Neer, interviews owners, they say, we have very slim, you know, profit margins. We have to make money. This is $10 a manicure. It hasn't gone up in a long, long time, the price. So the first story is about labor practice. The second story, which is equally shocking and frightening, is about the chemicals that are used in all kinds of nail-related and, to a certain extent, hair and other kinds of beauty products that these women imbibe, you know, absorb day after day, putting on acrylic nails, taking off nail polish, etc. At least three of which are toxic, one of which is formaldehyde, a carcinogen, and it is also documentation both from workers that she interviews, same reporter, dear listeners, and then from doctors, and then from some research scientists, and from some industry lobbyists, industry group representatives of what kind of health hazards these face. So both it's a 1-2 punch, dear listeners, and it's around something in some ways, that has become for many, many, many women. One interesting subset of questions is, when did pedicures and manicures become a kind of, you know, de rigueur must-have kind of thing for the American middle class, because part of this story is about the astounding proliferation of nail salons since the early 1990s. But for many, many consumers, this will be big, big news. Two postscripts. One, the New York Times has an editorial about this today. And two, and just as interesting, calling for labor practices, greater oversight, enforcement of laws, et cetera. And two, just as interesting, Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York staff, read this on Sunday morning, the second story on Sunday morning in the Times, and immediately has launched an aggressive investigation and a whole bunch of initiatives. So that's also in the Times today.
Well, you know, you ask about when having your nails and toenails done became de rigueur. I would say it was at the same time that all of these and Vietnamese, Korean, because that's what I usually see in Boston, nail salons opened up with offering $30 for a manicure and a pedicure. Okay. And suddenly you thought, $30 for a manicure and a pedicure? That's fantastic. So I think that is the question for most of our listeners who are not in New York City. They're in Boston. And I think that's about what they still cost. It might be $12 or $14 for a manicure, but it's still pretty cheap. What do we think is going on here?
Well, I think that's a very, very interesting question. It's not like this is an industry that, say, unlike the textile industry, where different, you know, like remember the Nike child labor scandal 15 years ago now, that has had, you know, kind of the light of investigative reporting or consumer activism on it. It has not. So in Boston, my own anecdotal sense is that a lot, rather than Koreans being the majority of the manicurists, we're talking about in terms of immigrants, it being Vietnamese.
Yes.
And it's very interesting to speculate what's the situation in all these salons that are, you know, that pepper lots of parts of the city. There was a very interesting map in the New York Times showing that in many, many neighborhoods in Manhattan, nail salons are much more prevalent than Starbucks.
Oh, absolutely. They're everywhere.
There are something like 2,000 nail salons in you know, I think in the five boroughs, but where the overwhelming majority of those are clustered in New York.
In the section of Washington Square in Brookline, which is near where I live, I think there are three, if not four, nail salons all within like a couple of blocks. And they're always doing a big business. And they're open very long hours, you know, till 7 o'clock at night during the week. I think it's 6 o'clock on the weekends. But they are working
They're working very, very long hours. When I had my first manicure, I was a graduate student at Harvard in the PhD program. A friend of mine who was always dressed to the nines. I mean, just Tess O'Toole, gorgeous PhD student in comp lit, had her nails done. She said, come along. And I thought, my God, I'm not going to get my nails done. That's just so out of reach and so like, Lucille Ball and I Love Lucy and Where's Desi Arnaz? And it just seemed like a different world. And that was probably, well, it's 1991 or 1992. And now, I mean, I went for a period in my life when I had my nails done every week, and it was like as important as, you know, I don't know, putting on makeup. It became a kind of very, very essential thing. So I think part of what we're seeing is an industry which has very, very low cost to entry. So you're a young entrepreneur from whatever background. You can set up a nail salon or a beauty salon if you're not going to service hair very cheaply. You need a few estheticians, a few people to do your nails. Then you need rent. And you need a couple of chairs and you need bottles of polish.
Right.
It's not a very capital intensive, not an industry with very high barriers to entry. So that's a piece of it. And I think American consumers, they were talking about women primarily, right? American consumers have seen in the last 25 years this fascinating aspect of increasing amounts of what, you know, Thorsten Veblen, Max Weber would call conspicuous consumption. As income inequality has risen, interestingly enough, all these things we do to identify ourselves as not falling behind, including manicures and pedicures, which are symbolic consumption as well as, you know, personal investment and empowerment and all the things that women think about around beauty, have increased dramatically. And yet, here's the real fundamental issue in these stories. They're so well done, is there's a backstory here. There's a backstory. Do we want to see as consumers? Do we want to see that backstory? Do we want to pull the curtain up and look at what's behind $10 manicure or the T-shirt, right? The shirt I'm wearing that's, you know,
the answer is
it's nylon shirt.
We don't give a damn. I mean, I was saying to Marjorie this morning, you have to be dumber than a post to all of a sudden read this thing and be shocked. If you're paying $10 for a manicure, the fact that you had no idea and that Governor Cuomo and his staff had no idea there were grotesque violations of law in this companion piece. This companion piece that this woman writes, Near, in the New York Times, she says, in interviews with more than 125 manicurists across the region who have worked all told in 300 nail shops, only three spoke of salons that appear to obey the law, letter of law. And then she gets, so the notion that this could be this widespread, and in this era, nobody, none of the customers knew anything about it, the government, no regulators, no inspectors, no nothing, nobody knew anything about it. This is like Captain, what was his name, Renault, walking in a Rick's Cafe.
Wait a minute. I don't think you spend a lot of time in nail salons.
No, I do not spend a huge amount of time.
I think that I know a lot of people that do, and I don't think it certainly didn't occur to me, and I've been there many
times.
Willful
ignorance on the part of most people.
No, I don't
think
it's willful.
Yes, it is.
What you think is, and I'll tell you what you think. You think that a lot of the women that are there maybe they're illegally because they don't speak the language.
Many don't speak the language.
So you're doing them a favor by underpaying them?
No, you're not doing a favor by underpaying them. I think a lot of people give them very big tips, which now I realize is pointless because
they're
not
getting them anyway.
They don't get to keep them.
But I think you figure that they are young women who are just in the country, and this is the job they're doing. And so they when they first get here, and they'll move on to something else. And I think that you have a lot of people in these small salons, so you figure that they're a little bit cheaper than if you went to a hairdresser. Mm-hmm. Where they would be much more expensive. So I don't think most people had any idea that people were sleeping in bunk beds above the
salons. By the way,
there
is a story in one of her pieces, this Near's pieces, not about 10-hour days, but about some woman that's working there 6 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
She goes and takes a nap, and when the door opens, she wakes up and then does somebody's nails, and then she goes back to sleep afterwards.
And I think you also see in a lot of these salons, you see the women with their kids.
Right.
So you figure that this is a place that they can bring their children to, not have to worry about daycare. You know, you do wonder, you see a lot of them with the masks on, and you think about whatever it is you do with your nails, where I'm not sure what it is you're doing, but they have the people like looks like they're sawing them off with a drill or something.
So, dear listeners, in case you're not a regular consumer in a nail salon, there are a couple of different kinds of manicures. One is to just take your nail, file and clean your nails, and put polish and top coat on it. A second kind of a manicure is to actually apply acrylic tips.
That's it.
And they use a powder mix that's mixed up and basically applied over your nail to give your nail a hard, perfectly shaped coating. This is a very, very popular thing. And then to paint it. And then those are drilled off or filed with a drill later on. And they last about 2 weeks. And it costs more than the $10 manicure that Marjorie's talking about. And then there's a third manicure that's emerged that's very popular over the last 2 years called a gel manicure, in which you use a certain kind of polish that basically creates a very, very hard surface for your nail without the cumbersomeness that we're talking in degrees of acrylic nails, and yet lasts as long as 2 weeks without chipping. That also costs more. All of these procedures involve very, very significant chemicals.
You know what that last procedure is called? It's called the love canal manicure. I mean, it's like going into a toxic dump. You know, can I just whine for one more second? This is a horrible situation. I don't know that I'm right, that people should have known and chose not to know. But also, this woman writes in this companion piece.
Called, by the way, Three Ways to be Socially Conscious.
Yeah, listen to this way. And you two
to be a socially conscious
consumer. You have manicures or pedicures. Tell me when you're going to do this next. One of her three pieces of advice is interview your manicurist. And here's what you should do, Marjorie and Nancy. Sitting across from a nail worker provides an opportunity for dialogue, a chance to ask how much the person doing your nails is paid, or if the worker was made to pay a fee to the employer to start working. When are you having that conversation? That's like talking to your barista about race.
Well, of course, the joke about going into nail salons that you share among your girlfriends lots of times, because a lot of people don't speak English, and you see three or four women speaking Vietnamese or speaking Korean, whether they're speaking, and they're all laughing and joking. You, of course, think they're making fun of your ugly feet.
You.
Yeah, they're making fun of your feet and your toenails. Or what's wrong with your nail polish or your nail polish color, something like that. So you're not having those conversations with, although you do have occasionally the conversation about the kids. And
the problem is here? We're talking, maybe the reason I'm in this mood about this is a little while ago, Nancy, we spoke to this guy, David Hoffman, who's doing this Frontline piece on chicken. I forget what the thing is called, the problem with chicken. Thank you, Chelsea, the trouble with chicken. Mm-hmm. And the moral of that particular particular hour-long documentary is the government has completely fallen down on the job. The moral of this story is the government has completely fallen down. So you can be as socially conscious a consumer as you want, and you should be. The reality is it is the obligation of government to enforce wage laws, occupational safety and health laws, and they are doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that is a huge issue here. There's a very interesting suggestion. It's a little bit stronger than that in the Times editorial about, you know, you think about the Bureau of Homeland Security's bloated budget, right? Mm-hmm. And they're so worried about certain immigrants, and we're so unworried. We're so, you know, we're so halcyon about this situation obtaining with illegal immigrants. They're being very much exploited. What Jim and Marjorie didn't expand on, dear listeners, is that many of these workers live in apartments that are one room with 12 people.
Yeah.
Some of them live in bunk beds in basements that were below the shop. It is something out of Theodore Dreiser. Now, there's other parts of the economy, other parts of the supply chain here. We've talked about this at great length when we've talked about some of Apple's supplying operations in China where they put together iPhones. This is not new news. But it does raise this question that's, I think, really interesting. And it does – there's something about a manicure and a pedicure where someone is touching your feet and touching your hands. I actually have been going to a woman who's a Russian who runs her own little shop for years and years and years and years, always worried about her inhaling all those fumes and all that dust. But my point is there's something very, very personal and very intimate about this. And yet we as consumers are, and Jim, I think there's something to what you say about willful ignorance, at some level not choosing to peel back what is really going on with everyday low, low prices.
You know what happened? We're going to discuss this with listeners after you go, Nancy. But I hearken back to, I was saying to Marjorie this morning, remember when the New York Times did those stories about the conditions, not just for Chinese workers, Chinese child workers in these Apple plants. You know what the basic rationale?
Foxconn is one of the bigs when they talked a lot
about.
One
of the things that caused most of us, our listeners and us, to basically get to the point where, well, we can excuse this is, you know what it was? When all the stories that were followed up saying, well, everybody's doing this. Samsung is treating people poorly too. So unless you want to give up electronics, this is something, a completely insane rationale for subsidizing the mistreatment, despite what Apple says about how great the improvements have been. Our bottom line, I think the bottom line in this country, with very few exceptions, is if we can get a good deal at a manicure or an iWatch or whatever it is,
well,
we don't really care how it got to us.
I mean, we have this conversation about the made in America thing. When you look at where your clothing is made, if you buy it at an inexpensive place, it's almost always made in Vietnam or someplace far away. And you go to a place where the clothing is made in America, and it is very, very expensive. Yeah. So people, I mean, a lot of people buy all their kids' clothing at Old Navy. Why do they buy their kids' clothing at Old Navy? Because it's cheaper at Old Navy. And, you know, there's that middle-aged woman store, Eileen Fisher, which always talks about how they have, you know, they pay their workers well, and they have, you know, they don't use all these terrible chemicals at the farm. And you go to buy a sweater at Eileen Fisher, and you're talking $250.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think this is a very, very interesting issue. Now, you think about organic meat cage-free hens. We're going to talk. You know, you talked about salmonella and chicken, right? Or some of the ways in which a more humane treatment of our meat supply is beginning to come into, you know, not only just, you know, outlying areas, but beginning to move in certain ways more mainstream. And that meat costs more. So I really think this is an issue about what are we willing to see? What are we willing to see first, second? That's a very interesting question. And second, then what are we willing to do with what we see? I mean, Janet, the reason this story is really powerful is it's unmistakable. Some of us have some ideas of this. Some of us are like, oh, I've always known this. Maybe I'm going to change my behavior. I did read a lot of the comments, or a lot of comments, dear listeners, and a lot of women said, that's it. I'm done. I'm glad I've had my last manicure. Or I gave up.
I'm not watching a National Football League game anymore after Ray Rice.
Hold
How
on.
Many of
you
us?
You can go to the hairdresser. I mean, lots of
mean?
Hair.
Yeah.
Well, I think what people used to do before there were all these Vietnamese hair, especially if you're getting married or going to the prom or something, you go to the hairdresser and there would be a manicurist at the hairdresser. you were paying a lot more money to the manicurist at the hairdresser, and no one was. I mean, that's before.
And if you go to a Nevada salon or a National salon, those people are bonded. They are legitimate, and they are paid, and they are adhering to OSHA regulations. So, you know, there are many different things, but I'm really struck by this. What are we willing to look at? And we are willing to look at certain things, and then we aren't willing to look at other things. There's a wonderful videotape that we use in a lot of the coaching I do, and it's a famous one. Many of our listeners will know. It's called the Gorilla Tape, the Gorilla Video, and it's a 60-second tape, and it's a bunch of college students bounce passing basketballs, four basketballs across a circle, and you show the tape, and you say to the group or the people or anyone, count the number of times the ball changes hands. And so you run the tape, and 50 seconds into a 60-minute video, a woman in a gorilla suit, unmistakable, walks in, waves at the camera, and walks out. And then you stop the tape, and you ask, how many times did the balls change hands? And this has been shown. It's a long, old videotape. It was made by a SUNY professor of organizational behavior many, many years ago. It was an experiment, like the Zimbardo experiment.
State University of New York.
Excuse me,
a SUNY, Shia.
State University of New York.
No, it's fine.
And it's like the Zimbardo experience. It's been pivotal. In any event, no matter, millions and millions and millions of times, and on average, about one-third of the people see the gorilla. So two-thirds don't see the gorilla. And you ask people, I've done this many, many times, and you ask people, and the groups inevitably say, what gorilla? When someone finally says, what about the gorilla? And so my point is, we don't see the gorilla. But some of that is about counting basketballs in our inboxes and all the things we're not being present for. And some of it is, we don't want to see the gorilla. So I think this is a really interesting, wonderful story about very decent, hardworking people who are ground up health-wise and economically and emotionally in a mill that many, many women, myself included, have consciously or unconsciously supported. And it's no different than lots and lots of aspects of our consumer behavior. But it is, we are maybe entering a time when enough is enough, and we need to think very carefully about the choices we make and how right we feel with ourselves about those choices. Because this is ultimately left at some very, very fundamental level to every single consumer.
I couldn't agree more. Nancy, thank you.
That was wonderful, Nancy. I can't go back. That's it for me. No more Vietnamese. I have to go find some snazzy spa, I guess. Get my.
So you had no idea that when you're paying $10, there was something going on.
You know
something?
I feel ashamed of myself, but frankly, I didn't think about it. I thought it was an entry level job for
these
young
women. Counting the basketballs. Miss the gorilla.
They were just coming in, and they all seemed very nice, and I have been straightened out. Anyway, Nancy Kanin is a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. The latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy joins us every Tuesday. Coming up, we're going to ask you, are you an ethical consumer? Do you forgo things like manicures because you know the human cost behind them? Or can your moral compass only take you so far? We're asking you that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.